Well, as soon as Wes shows up, please let me know and I'll give him a few minutes to come up here and speak. But often I don't get to see because of the lighting here. So this is actually the first full day in 3 weeks that I've been in California. So I do thank you for stepping in, Mark, while I was gone. And I managed to get a little bit of vacation time in, too. It was sandwiched between a trip to the Museum of the Bible and to Regent University. I was in Virginia, literally, just last night. And what happened at the Museum of the Bible, I mean, last time I was here, I left the class and got on an airplane, headed to Washington, D.C. And what we discovered is that, by the way, the Museum of the Bible, it's on Museum Row, right on the Mall of Washington, D.C. It's a six-story building. They took an old railroad place and basically converted it. Six stories fills a whole city block. And the museum is about two-thirds completed. They brought Fuz Rana, our staff biochemist, and myself to Washington, D.C. to consult on a new exhibit they're developing, which is basically science and the Bible. And so they had an outline, and we were able to help them with features of the outline that would have been a problem. And they're very eager to partner with us to really try to make that an effective museum. The challenge is that the museum is set up as a nonprofit and a secular, which means they do not take a position. So it's not an even, a lot of people think it's an evangelical message. It's not. And they've included Muslims, they've included Jews, they've included Eastern Orthodox, unbelievers as well. But the whole point is to communicate the impact of the Bible on human society. So we're going to continue to consult with them on the science component. And by the way, it's a magnificent museum. Everything is first class there. If you ever get a chance to go, I mean, it's really worth seeing. The latest exhibit they had there, they had just opened it as we arrived, and it's about one quarter of one floor of the building, and it's on the Bible and slavery, in particular American slavery. Basically focuses on the Civil War era, pre-Civil War era, and something I wasn't aware of, I think a lot of Americans aren't aware of, there was a Bible war going on between the pro-slavery Americans and the abolitionists. And what the abolitionists did is they took the Bible and basically highlighted all the passages that basically said that slavery was wrong, that it was a sin, and slaves need to seek the freedom, and slave owners need to repent, etc. What was quite shocking to me about the pro-slavery people, they produced their own Bible, but they took out all the passages that were anti-slavery. They took out the entire book of Exodus, took out the entire book of Revelation, and stripped all the other passages. For example, the passage in Galatians and in Romans, that was all taken out, as well as a lot of Old Testament texts. And that's what was given to the slaves. And it, what was interesting about the abolitionist movement is how they would go to the slaves and tell them, you need the whole Bible. And they were given the entire Bible. And it was amazing the impact this had. They said, oh, look at all the stuff that was left out. And had an amazing impact. But their whole comment was, this is not the only issue on which there's been these kind of Bible battles. I mean, in fact, there was kind of a subtle thing about how certain cults will take the Bible and they will just take certain verses out and leave the rest out. I mean, you're probably aware there are people that come in suits to your front door promoting a particular interpretation of the Bible. And what I found out about these ladies and women, or ladies and men, is they're really expert on about 380 Bible verses. But talk about anything other than those 380 Bible verses, they really don't know what's going on. In fact, regardless of what kind of cultist comes to my front door, that's how I always talk to them, is saying, have you read the entire Bible? And interestingly, they always say they have. And so I start asking them questions. And then it becomes quite obvious that they haven't. and said, well, you know, you need to actually sit down and go through it cover to cover from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22. And they all say, well, that's way too hard to do. And so I said, well, have you read the Harry Potter novels, or have you read Lord of the Rings? Those are all much longer than the Bible. So anyway, that was what was happening the last Sunday that I was here. And just the last 3 days, I've been at Regent University in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I was going there to address the faculty. Every year they have a retreat for all their professors. And it's quickly becoming the largest Christian university. There are now over 11,000 students. So I think only Liberty and Baylor are larger at this point. And but what I found encouraging is that they really want all their professors to become scholar evangelists, not only able to evangelize their undergraduate students that are coming, but their secular peers. And so they brought me in to basically have a couple of days with them where we talked about that very thing, how to become, and a course of reasons to believe are doing that very thing, developing a community of research scientists and other scholars and equipping them to evangelize their peers. So, and incidentally, the chancellor of the university, Pat Robertson, actually purchased a copy of this book, and it's required reading for all the professors there at Regent University. And the reason why is that Pat was persuaded that it's this book that's basically going to communicate to the professors that leading your peers to Christ is the norm for the Christian faith. We're all to do that. And because a lot of people, in fact, this is part of the message this morning, you know, did the miracle stop with the first century? When you read the book of Acts, notice how the book of Acts ends. You get to the last chapter of the book of Acts, there's no conclusion. It just stops. It stops dead. The fact that it just stops without a conclusion tells you this is to continue throughout all generations of the church. And, you know, my wife and I wrote this book basically to document it's not just the first century. It happens today. It happens to anyone who will prepare good reasons for the hope that they have within them and can share them with gentleness and respect. Now, some of the pushback I got from the professors, they said, well, Hugh, of course you get all these opportunities to speak to scientists and theologians when you're on airplanes and when you're in grocery stores because you're a scientist. Well, there was a member of this class, he's not here today, but he came out of the Mormon faith. He travels a lot just like I do, but he says, you know, when I'm on airplanes, I get to talk to Mormons and Jack Mormons. You ever heard of the term Jack Mormon? That's someone who was in the Mormon church and left the Mormon church. So I get to talk to people with doctoral degrees in science and theology. He gets to talk to people who were in the Mormon church or just left the Mormon church. The whole point is God will use whatever good reasons you prepare. He knows who you are, and he's going to bring the right people to you at the right time. And of course, the professors back there were saying, well, how do you get the opportunities? Because I said, you know, we're on airplanes and stuff, and we don't get it. Says, well, you have to practice. It didn't happen to me 40 years ago. You have to practice this thing. And the best way is to ask questions. One thing I've noticed about strangers that I engage, they like to talk about themselves. So if you ask questions, they'll tell you all about themselves. And that's important because now you get to find out what kind of non-Christian you're dealing with. And once you discover what kind of non-Christian you're dealing with, then you'll be prepared to give the reasons that will be appropriate for them. I think what really stymies a lot of evangelism is Christians, you thinking one tool works on everybody. One size fits all. One size does not fit all. And it's important to really determine what kind of person you're talking to before you actually prepare reasons to share. And then people said, well, how do you develop the gentleness and respect? I said, well, ask the non-Christian. I mean, I find that, you know, when you're sharing your faith with a non-Christian, He asked the question, "Can you please tell me where I was obnoxious in the way I shared my faith with you?" They're very eager to tell you. And that will help you next time you talk to somebody. So get feedback. And it takes time. The Apostle Paul waited 14 years before he began his ministry. So it takes time. Yes? He's the chancellor. He actually founded Regent University 41 years ago as an arm of the Christian Broadcasting Network. He's still the chancellor. So I gave 2 1.5-hour talks. He gave a 20-minute talk. He basically gave a charge. It was very encouraging because he basically said this partnership between Reasons to Believe and Regent University has got to happen. So he basically gave a strong exhortation to the faculty and the deans to take advantage of the equipping that Reasons to Believe can provide for them. So I think we're going to see a really strong partnership. And for that matter, I shared with them that for 30 years, we've been looking for a Christian university that wanted to work with us where we could raise up their professors to be effective evangelists to their peers. This is the first university that basically said, we're in. Other universities we approached, I won't give names, basically there was an intimidation factor. You know, we don't want to do this. This is not our calling. Our calling is to minister to Christian students. But I see with these, I think what's interesting too, most of the faculty at Regent had secular careers first. And so they purposely tend to hire people who've got a strong secular academic background and bring them in to the university. So I think that's a big advantage that they've done that. Yes, in the back.
Wes and Jackie
are here. Yeah, thank you. All right, we're going to give you a few minutes to share with the class. I'll pick up where I left off when you're done. So please come forward.
It's very good to be back to my home church and to my home Sunday school class, and thank you.
Hey, get real close to that.
All righty. You can hear us now? So we are back we'll be here 4 more Sundays. We've had quite a long furlough. We came to the UK in the 5th of April, and they were there a little over 4 months. I kept saying, Jackie, we're shortchanging our time in the UK with you and your home church, so we're taking longer with you all. And then we came the 1st of August and spent a little time with my daughter in New York and Brooklyn, and then a week with my stepmom, who's 91, in Chattanooga, and now about 6 weeks in Southern California. Then back to Arizona for a week to see the Grand Canyons with
three sisters.
Three sisters that Jackie knew growing up in Malawi. And then we'll go back and spend some more time with my stepmom and I have a sister in Kentucky. So we're trying to touch all the bases. We come with a good report. We have been faithful in the work. And dedicating the Baca New Testament in March of 2017. This also has the book of Genesis in it, so I'm very glad we don't have just the New Testament, but we also have the book of Genesis. They had drafted Exodus 1 through 20, but they felt the urgency of publishing. This was a project that had began work in the early 1980s, and sometimes long periods because of civil war and other problems where the translation was interrupted, and they were just feeling this impellingment to finish. So their Exodus 1 through 20 waits for a later day. The next one that we dedicated was the Dodinga New Testament. So the Baka are near Congo, about halfway up South Sudan. South Sudan follows the border with Congo and the Democratic Republic, DRC.
DRC, yeah, Democratic Republic of Congo.
follows the continental divide. So it kind of goes up and it makes this bend. And just as it's bending, about halfway up South Sudan is Maridi, and that is the Baka area. The Dinga are very near the border of Kenya and Uganda. So they're very much in the southeast part of South Sudan. And I think I feel the most at home with this language family. The Dinga, the Larum, the Tenet, and the Murley are all closely related languages, Sirmic languages. And we dedicated this in March of 2018. And this has Genesis, Exodus 1 through 24, Ruth and Jonah, and the New Testament. And so that was quite a joy. And related to the Dinga, the Larum are doing what we call an adaptation. I use a window in Paratext, the translation software, that puts an English word or phrase under each of their words, which allows me to pretty much read back to them in English what they're saying in their language. The Larum are using that same window to put a Larum word or phrase under each Dinga word for a first draft. And it makes the initial drafting go quite well, and the things that are well done in the Dinga get carried over into Larum. And so that's nice. A lot of the good exegetical choices made in the Dinga come into the Larum. And I made first contact with a Joseph in 2008, the first time I visited the Dinga home village of Chukudum, and he sat on the front. I had prayed, "Lord, who will come?" You know, you make the announcement, just like the parable of the king that invites people to the wedding and no one shows up. Well, we had made the announcement in the Catholic Church on Sunday of this workshop, a community check of the Gospel of John, and I wondered who is coming, who will come, and I prayed that prayer, "Lord, who will come?" And we had 35 to 45 come each of 4 days, so we were very happy with the turnout, but one of the men who came was Joseph. 89 years of age, ramrod tall, straight, a nice white goatee. He sat on the front right-hand side every day, and his English was quite good. We talked at tea breaks and before and after our time, and he said, "I am Joseph. I can speak Dinga, but I am not Dinga. I am Larum, and nothing has been done to bring God's word to my people. God meant me to meet you to help bring God's word to my people." He was actually being modest because the Catholic Church had published a Sunday prayer missal that had scripture readings for a cycle each Sunday of the year for a 3-year cycle of readings, a 3-volume Sunday prayer missal. And that was published in 97 and 98. So that was the first access of scripture to the Dinga people. And Joseph's son, Clement, had tried to use this with the Larum. He was a lay teacher in the Catholic Church called a catechist, and tried to use that Sunday prayer missal, and the Larum just refused it. Their languages are close, but enough different that it was confusing to them. And so he, not to be deterred, got journal books, cloth-bound journal books, lined, and started translating these Sunday prayer missals, and was using them. So when I met Clement then in July of 2008, the only thing written in Larum was in what he had translated by hand. Quite a humbling thing to see. You know, you're starting from ground zero. And this now is the Larum, 4 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here there are the epistles from Galatians to James. This represents 64% of the New Testament. We've also published their Acts and published their Genesis and Exodus 1 through 24 as one volume. And they will publish their New Testament and the Old Testament books of Genesis, Exodus 1 through 24, Ruth, Jonah, and the Psalms in 2022. And the Psalms are coming in because the Catholic Church asked us to help revise the Sunday prayer missal after we published the Dinga New Testament, and we saw every Sunday they had a psalm. And so we were checking the Old Testament passages in the Sunday prayer missals that were not in our published Bible, And I had the translators translate the whole psalm, because sometimes they only had a portion of the psalm in the Sunday prayer missal. And as a result of that, we have 130 psalms finished in the Dodinga now, and the Larum will get those and publish that. And then here is the Calico New Testament. And this people group live right against Congo and Uganda. So they're in the southwestern part of South Sudan. And this received quite a bit of media attention. And if you will look at my newsletter, if you don't, I have some other copies of my newsletter if you're not receiving them.
Right there.
Oh, you have them there. And if you're not receiving them, please, my email address is there, and email me, and I'll get you on the list, okay? But the Calico New Testament, there's a link there. You can watch the on YouTube a thing Wycliffe did about the Calico Translation Project. This happened to be the 1,000th New Testament that Wycliffe Bible Translators helped to produce. And so this was quite a joy. And this was dedicated in August of last year, right about this time. And the good news, the Baya and the Tenet, New Testaments are at the printers, and they also include Genesis, Exodus 1 through 20, Ruth and Jonah. And I feel a tremendous sense of relief that that's done. You know, this thing of five New Testaments and sometimes the chaos of South Sudan, you wondered if it would all come apart and not get finished. So we're very happy that that is done. And upcoming, in addition to the Larum finishing in 2022, the Dinka Cham, a Southern Dinka, are publishing a whole Bible. They're just finishing their Old Testament now, and then they're going to, other consultants are working with them in revising their New Testament and publishing a Bible. So 2022, Dinka Cham Bible at Southern Dinka, and Larum New Testament, and we're beginning work with six other languages. One will be an Old Testament project, the Dinka Rek, another dialect of Dinka, and then the Lapit and the Mundari and the Bongo and the Beli and the, help me.
The Lapit, I haven't been listening.
Mundari. Bongo, Beli, six new languages that were in, the Dinka Rek, the Dinka Rek would go on to become an Old Testament project. These others are finishing, they have finished Genesis at this point. They are now going onward to do Exodus 1 through 24, and then they will go on to do New Testaments. So that is our joy, our work, and my dear wife, I'm talking all the time, so you say hi.
Hello. I didn't really quite realize we actually had a slot today, so I'm complete surprised. I'm kind of a bit suddenly in the lights, but it's lovely to be with you, and God's been really blessing us in South Sudan, and it is a time of reaping, particularly with the five New Testaments being complete. But anyway, and it's good to be here a little while. So, God bless.
And what do you do, dear?
My background is actually in literacy and education work. And so in the translation work with the languages that Wes is working, I've also been working, at least with some of them, to do literacy and education work. So those communities have some books, they can teach children, and they can teach adults in the church to read and write. And we also work with the government on education as well, so we have a partnership with them. So that's also been a delight to see that. And I'm also now the director, so I actually have an administrative role in South Sudan, making sure projects run, seeing strategically what work we should be doing, and making sure projects have funding as well. So,
good. So we will be here, and happy to have any questions you may have. Happy to have any questions you may ask after Hugh's time. Thank you. Well, if you go back to 1900, so we're talking about 119 years ago, all the languages of South Sudan were oral only. They were not written. Okay, so the writing of languages in South Sudan have all taken place since 1900. And the larger languages began to receive scripture probably in the 1920s, 1930s. And for example, the Dinka Cham New Testament was published in 59, but I think they had scripture earlier than that. They had the Psalms earlier. So the larger languages received Bibles earlier, the Newer, the Bari. Larger languages received Bibles earlier. We tend to work with smaller languages, and we have finished now. There were seven other languages that we had finished prior to this, and there's five that we're finishing now. There's 65 languages in all of South Sudan, and so there are probably about another 15 or so that need beginning work. The rest have something that has been done, being done at this time. Yes?
How distinct are the languages from each other? Very related? Some aren't. Meaning, in their roots, there are some words that are
common. I'm not catching you.
How distinct are the languages from each other?
Well, the Dadinga, the Larum, the Tenet, and the Murli are all in the same language family, Surmic. So I can go from one of those languages to the others, and it's very easy because the structure is the same. But we probably have two or three different language families in South Sudan. The Indo-European language family goes from English to French to Spanish to Sanskrit in India, Greek. So a language family can still be a very broad thing, but South Sudan has different language families. So, you know, the Bongo that I'm working with in Genesis is totally different. The Baya, one of the New Testaments finishing, have marked five tones, a very, very different type of language than the Dinka, for example. So that is something that makes a challenge. Other parts of Africa would almost all be Bantu languages, and they would be very similar to one another. So it would be very easy if someone working in Tanzania, for example, Bantu languages. So it's very easy to go from one to another. But in South Sudan, the languages can be very, very diverse from one another. Yeah. Let me not take more of your time, Hugh. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, I was mentioning the Museum of the Bible. One of the exhibits they have is a room where they actually have every Bible that's been translated. And they have a little neon sign thing there, basically alerting people how many New Testaments have been translated in different languages, how many complete Bibles have been translated, and every day they update it. So, and you can walk in there and pick up all the different languages of all the Bibles that have been translated. So that was very encouraging. Again, before I went to consult with the Museum of the Bible, by the way, I'm going to hand out the questions on Isaiah here. I don't know how far we're going to get today, but these are the study questions on Isaiah. I've only handed out 650 of these, but if you didn't get one of them, feel free to take one, or if you forgot to bring yours today. And the subject matter for today is what the book of Isaiah says about how the universe will end and how we'll enter into the new creation. And I got copies of these as well. You can distribute those. But before we get there, one of the papers that got published, because in between going to Museum of the Bible and speaking at Regent, and incidentally, when I was at Regent, I also got interviewed for the 700 Club. And that interview was supposed to be 10 minutes, but because it was Pat Robertson, they let it go for 16 minutes. And you'll see a link on both my Twitter and Facebook pages. So if you want to watch that interview, you can. And it's the first time I've been interviewed on television about extraterrestrial intelligent life and UFOs. So we actually have a little package prepared for people who want to dig more deeply into that. Anyway, that interview took place just a couple of days ago. yeah, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, I think it's back there at the table, so you can get that. And also we have a DVD called The R-UFO Hypothesis, and I suspect that's at that back table as well. And incidentally, we have a book table here every week with the Paradoxes class, and when they can share with you, the cheapest place to buy Reasons to Believe resources is right here in Paradoxes. So we have the ladies at the back there who will take care of you if you'd like to get some stuff. There's some free stuff back there as well. But in between Museum of the Bible and Regent University and the 700 Club, I took my wife for a 10-day trip into the wilds of British Columbia. And when I mean wilds, I'm not kidding. It's a place where there's no roads, there's no trails, there's no people. They basically drop you in with a helicopter, leave you there for a few days, and come back and helicopter you out. So, but I was reading a research paper just before we got it, and I shared it with Kathy, my wife. And it's a paper basically addressing what's called a worldwide mental health epidemic. But what's interesting about the paper is they identify what they believe is the cause of this epidemic, making the point that for the first time in human history, the majority of the world's population lives in dense metropolitan cities. And so that's where we're seeing the highest incidence of mental illness, and how little mental illness you see in rural parts of the world. And so the paper concluded saying what's happening in the 21st century is the majority of the world's population has little or no contact with wild nature. And actually the paper pointed out that those people who take time out of their metropolitan busy city life schedules to spend time in wild nature have a far lower incidence of mental health. So I was joking with my wife, dear, I'm taking you on this trip so we can sustain our mental health. I'm not sure she bought that entirely, so especially when we were, you know, hiking 9 and 10 hours a day. But what's interesting is when you get into these really wild places where humans have not been, is that you get to have a little taste of what it was like in the Garden of Eden. Because one of the things we've noted is that the animals treat you very differently than the animals who have had significant contact with humans. And so these are just a few of the photos I've taken, and I'll begin with this one back here. Here we go. See this guy? He weighs 450 pounds, and I was met him at about 10,000 feet elevation, and he came right out in front of me, and I didn't have any bear spray with me. So you can imagine how I was feeling at the time. But what happened is this bear walked to the side of me and sat down, and just sat down and waited. And so I figured, hey, if he's sitting down, he's not going to be a threat to me. So I was able to get several photos. This is one of the photos. I was about 25 feet away from him at this particular time. He was just curious. No, it's not a grizzly. That's a black bear. Yeah. I mean, when we were in Canada, they insisted that we take bear spray with us. And what's interesting, you got to take what's called a bear spray lesson. Because they said, most people who go into that part of British Columbia with bear spray, they don't know how to use it. A grizzly bear comes their way and they immediately get the thing out and spray it. And they said, it only works if the bear is within 12 feet of you. So they said, if you see a grizzly charging you, get the bear spray out and wait until the bear gets within, say, 5 to 12 feet of you, then you spray it. And you know, you got to aim for the face. So they said, you know, most people come in there, when they see a bear getting that close, they run away. And said, that doesn't work. You got to stand your ground with your bear spray and wait and aim. You want to make sure you aim in the right direction. Fortunately, we never had to use our bear spray. That didn't happen. So, but this is an example of a bear who just simply was curious. And he basically just sat down and let me take photos. And it didn't move. And since he wasn't getting up, I felt okay giving photos. All right. As we were going into British Columbia, we had to drive along the Trans-Canada Highway. It's basically the biggest highway going all the way across Canada. Here are four creatures who were at a construction site on the Trans-Canada Highway. And guess what? They were even obeying the speed limit there. They weren't going faster than 50 kilometers per hour. They're just curious. And I was able to walk up and take this photo. So, but then we got helicoptered in. Yes. They're taller than I am. I mean, they're big creatures. So, I mean, the tops of their horns are about 6.5 to 7 feet. So, I mean, these are big creatures. Now, these are males. The males are bigger than the females. I'm a little bit taller than they are, but not the males. The males are big, and these are young males. So,
male
pardon me?
What are they?
No, those are bighorn sheep. Yeah. I forget the exact name, but there's a certain species. These are the ones that have the biggest horns, and during rutting season, they bash one another pretty hard. No, they're not the Rocky Mountain Bighorn. They got another name. I think it starts with an M. I'm trying to remember the name. The horns are very robust, and their brains are designed to take collisions. Ours are not. I mean, a lot of NFL football players think that our brains are designed. They're not at all. But these are. Okay. Got helicoptered in, and one place we ran into lots of goats. Okay, this guy was as heavy as that bear I showed you. He's about 450 pounds. And what's interesting is there's usually one really big male mountain goat, and he's basically the king over all the other goats in the area, and is there to make sure nobody tampers with his females or with the kids. And so he basically took a position where he could watch everything. I wasn't aware that he was there, so I came up over the ridge and was face to face with this guy. He didn't move. He just kind of stared at me and waited till I took his photo. Okay. Here are a couple of his females. So, they're just very curious. And in fact, what's interesting, they'll even follow you as you walk along through the mountains. And this is just 2 days ago. I took, two days before I went to Regent University. This is a woolly marmot or a hoary marmot. There are marmots in the mountains of Colorado and Montana, but this is a special species. You only find them in Alaska and in Northwest Canada. And they're much bigger. This guy here measured about 30 inches from his nose to the end of his tail, weighed about 20 pounds. They're the second largest of the North American rodents, beavers being the largest. And they feel very safe because they only live in glacial terrain. You only see them where there's glaciers around, and they basically hang out with all the loose rocks created by the receding glacier. So if there's any threat, he just dives underneath the rock. And eagles are their main predator. And so they always hang around the rocks where they see an eagle, they just dive under the rock and they're fine. But when they see humans, they come out to greet them. And so I got within a few feet of this guy, and he just kept giving me different poses. Okay? And this is how close I was able to get to him. So, and they basically hibernate for 11 months of the year, and they get all their food in 1 month. So during that 1 month, they're very busy collecting food and storing it. And I found out they really don't hibernate like bears do. So they have to eat all the way through their hibernate. They basically hide underneath the rocks and stay warm. Well, it's snow that's there, but he's very busy collecting as much food as he can during the 1 month where there isn't snow on the ground. And incidentally, we were there and we got 8 inches of snow on us in August. So, but it's also true of the birds. You can get really close to the birds. This bird didn't seem bothered by us at all. And of course, then there's the Canadian ptarmigans, which will let you get extremely close to them. I mean, now I'm just a few inches away from this guy. And you know, they count on the fact that they're very good camouflage. Except you can see the tail is starting to turn white. They're anticipating that snow is going to come, and when snow comes, they become completely white. Okay. And when I came back, I discovered that there was a major breakthrough paper published in the journal Science, namely that they have done a brand new map of our Milky Way galaxy. By the way, the next book I'm going to be writing, I just finished a book on the crater and the climate, on the design that gives us the amazing climate stability we have today. But I've started work on my next book, and our staff says we want it titled Interior Designs. That will be the title, but it's got nothing to do with furniture. It's got nothing to do with decorating. It's all about the interior design of our galaxy cluster, our galaxy, our star, our sun, our moon, Earth, etc., that makes possible the existence of advanced life. But this is what you're seeing here is a three-dimensional map they've made of our Milky Way galaxy. It's the most extensive map ever made of our galaxy. This shows it edge-on. And that little red arrow basically shows you the biggest extent of the galaxy map to date. So, for example, this was done by a group of people at Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where they produced a face-on map of the Milky Way galaxy. That little yellow dot there shows you where our star, the Sun, is. Basically, we're halfway between the Sagittarius and Perseus spiral arms. And in this map, we're about halfway out from the center of the galaxy. However, what astronomers have done by mapping supergiant stars, Cepheid variable stars, what our whole galaxy is discovered, our galaxy is actually much bigger than this. And so the extent of the map that you see here is described by that red arrow. And basically says, my, there's a lot more of the galaxy that we have not yet really appreciated. And so our galaxy is not just 100,000 light years across, it's more than 400,000 light years across. Now, there's some exaggeration here. The central bulge is nowhere near as big as what you see in this map. And likewise, the spiral arm structure is nowhere near as thick as that. But what they were trying to do is show you that if you look far enough away from the center of our galaxy, you can see that the outer arms are warped. And so there's a subtle warp if you go out 200,000 light years from the center of our galaxy on both sides. A little bit warped down, a little bit warped up on the other edge. But what you notice is if you go out, say, 100,000 light years on either side of the center, no warp at all. Now, this is the only spiral galaxy we astronomers have seen where we can't see a warp 100,000 light years on either side of the center. To give you an example, here's a galaxy the same size as our galaxy. It's the Andromeda Galaxy. You can see it with a naked eye tonight if you've got with a pair of binoculars, it fills the whole field of view. But if you actually look at the Andromeda spiral structure, you can see it's got a significant warp in its spiral structure anywhere beyond, say, 10,000 light years out from the center. And because of that significant warp, advanced life is not possible in that galaxy. For advanced life to be possible, there can't be any warp within about 50,000 light years of the center of the galaxy. But this is what this map actually demonstrates. Perfectly flat until you get way, way out from the center. And that little yellow dot there basically shows you where our solar system would be relative to the center of that system. So you can see we're in that region where it's completely flat. Yes.
Is that because the spiral arms filter out harmful radiation?
Okay, what's happening with the spiral galaxy, this is interesting. Just today I got a text from David Block, an astronomer at Witwatersrand University in South Africa. He was the one that published a paper explaining why Andromeda has this very noticeable warp. He basically focused on, you'll notice there's two other galaxies in this photo. You see one bottom center, and you see one a little bit off to the left and above the center of Andromeda. And it's that dwarf galaxy. And by the way, it's a fairly big dwarf galaxy. He published a research paper where he did some velocity profiles of those two galaxies and the stars in the Andromeda galaxy, and basically made the point that that dwarf galaxy had actually passed right through the spiral arm structure of the Andromeda galaxy about a half billion years ago. And because of that, it's responsible for not all, but a significant part, a large part of the warp that you see in that Andromeda galaxy. And the reason why we don't have a big warp or even a little warp in our spiral galaxy is that there hasn't been a major dwarf galaxy come nearby our spiral galaxy over the last 10 billion years. The fact that the spiral structure is so symmetrical and is so undisturbed tells astronomers there's been no significant merger event over the past 10 billion years. The irony in all that, though, however, is you can only maintain the spiral structure if the spiral galaxy is consuming dwarf galaxies, unless it's bringing in, because dwarf galaxies are extremely gas-rich, and it takes a regular supply of gas from the outside to sustain the spiral structure of the galaxy. And so when a spiral galaxy stops consuming dwarf galaxies, the spiral structure collapses after three or four rotations, and you get what's called a spherical or ellipsoidal galaxy. When that happens, the stars all rush in together, and now the star density is way too great for any kind of life to exist in that galaxy. You say, how many galaxies are in that category? Well, in terms of the large galaxies, it's over 90%. Only 6% of the galaxies that we see in the universe today are spiral galaxies. And you have to have a spiral galaxy if you want life, and it needs to be a spiral galaxy where you have symmetrical arms, where there's no significant warp. And so what's unique about our galaxy, it's consuming small dwarf galaxies on a regular basis. It's consuming small dwarf galaxies, but no big ones, and no big ones come by. However, wait 4.5 billion years, it will happen. Yes.
So what is it about the warp that precludes life?
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, what is it about the warp that precludes life?
Yeah, thank you for using the microphone. Incidentally, if you're new here, this class is live streamed to the world. And so you're welcome to ask questions, but we ask you to wait for a microphone so the people who are participating in live streaming can appreciate this. What is it about the warming that precludes advanced life? The warping, yeah. The warping that precludes advanced life.
Yeah, you said.
Yeah.
So the galaxies can't sustain life.
Yeah, okay. I got the question, and just to give you an important caveat, it doesn't necessarily exclude a microbe, but it does exclude big plants and big animals, and especially intelligent beings. And the reason why, if you get this kind of a warp, what it does is disturbs the spiral structure enough that you get the spiral arms breaking up and producing spurs and feathers. And just to kind of show you here, there are some spurs and feathers in our Milky Way galaxy. And what these are tiny pieces of spiral arms that are broken off and fill the spaces between the spiral arms. If you get too much of that, it's going to gravitationally disturb the orbit of your star and the planets that are orbiting that star. And so if you want advanced life, you got to have long-lasting microbial life. And you want, and incidentally, the time window is important. I mean, for example, our star, the sun there, it crosses a spiral arm about once every billion years. And when it crosses a spiral arm, we're in big trouble. But it's been, we're exactly halfway between two spiral arms. That's the safe time in which we can exist as advanced life. But if one of these spurs or feathers that break off in the spiral arm were to get close to us, what that would do is expose us, because in these spurs and feathers and spiral arms are supergiant stars. These supergiant stars radiate deadly radiation. Not necessarily deadly for microbes, but definitely deadly for us. Moreover, you get these molecular clouds. They're big, dense bodies, and big stars cause gravitational disturbances, which could disrupt the comets and asteroids in your system. I mean, for example, when we do cross a spiral arm, you get a rush of comets and asteroids coming in and colliding with the Earth. So a lot of the big mass extinction events that we can document actually can be traced to when we had one of those disturbances take place. So, and also you want the spiral arms to be reasonably far apart. Some spiral galaxies, the spiral arms are too close together. You want them far apart, and you want to be in a spiral galaxy, because only in a spiral galaxy are the stars far enough apart from one another that you're not going to get disturbances. The vast majority of stars, the spiral structures collapse, which means the stellar density is way too high. You're going to get gravitational disturbances. You're going to get radiation issues. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
In this picture, where can we be in size compared to this?
Where can we be what?
The size of our universe. Can we compare to this? Where would we be?
Okay. There are about 100 billion galaxies in our universe that are the same size as our galaxy or the Andromeda Galaxy. And there are a few hundred billion more galaxies that are smaller. Most of the galaxies in the universe are dwarf galaxies. I don't have the visual here, but I've created a map of what's our local group, our little galaxy cluster. And in our galaxy cluster, we got two big galaxies, ours and Andromeda, and you got 100 small ones. And incidentally, the reason why we are consuming tiny dwarf galaxies and not big dwarf galaxies, it's thanks to the large and small Magellanic clouds. Again, I don't have the visual here, but if you were to go about 200,000 light years away from our Milky Way galaxy, there are two really big dwarf galaxies. And these dwarf galaxies act as a gravitational funnel, dragging tiny dwarf galaxies into the center of our spiral galaxy, and that's what's sustaining our spiral arm structure. It's important that our galaxy get to eat a small dwarf galaxy on a regular basis. But it's thanks to the small and large Magellanic clouds that we're getting that steady diet without being bombarded by big dwarf galaxies, as was the case with the Andromeda Galaxy. This will all be going in the book called Interior Designs. If you want a little taste of it, I put a little tidbit of this information in the book Improbable Planet.
Yeah.
Yes. Another question?
Actually, I have two questions. On the prior image of the Milky Way Galaxy.
This one?
No, the one last one. When we look into the night sky where you can see the Milky Way, are we seeing the first spiral arm above the green dot in this image?
Yeah, when you look up at the sky and see the Milky Way, you're looking at either the spiral arm that's between us in the center of the galaxy, or you're looking at the spiral arm that's away from the center of the galaxy. So the Sagittarius spiral arm is towards the center of the galaxy, the Perseus spiral arm is away from the center. And yeah, when you look at the Sagittarius spiral arm, you can actually see a really bright spot in the middle of it. That's where you're kind of looking straight at the center of the galaxy. So yeah, tonight you can actually see the constellation Sagittarius. And if you look at it, you're looking towards the center of the galaxy.
So this image and the others you have look for all the world like photographs, but nobody was standing out there with a camera. So
no, this is not a photograph.
How are these created?
Okay. How these were created. Yeah, a lot of people look at them and say, wow, how did they get a satellite up there and look down on them? No, you can't do that. That's hundreds of thousands of light years away you'd have to be. What they've done is they look at pieces of the galaxy and kind of jigsaw puzzle them together to make this map. And the only reason they've been able to do that is that they actually are piecing together portions of our galaxy observed at different wavelengths. So for example, at optical wavelengths, dust in our galaxy blocks out about 80% of our entire galaxy. But radio wavelengths tend to be able to see right through it. And so it's a combination of infrared, gamma ray, ultraviolet, radio wavelengths, millimeter wave wavelengths. They've been able to get to different portions of our galaxy and basically piece it all together. It was a multi-year project by people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Caltech that was responsible for producing this map. But yeah, it's basically a jigsaw puzzle type effort to pull that together, as opposed to this where a single photograph can capture the whole thing. Not the case with this. And that actually explains this map. This is an independent attempt to map our Milky Way galaxy, but with the goal of not just mapping the central portion of our galaxy, but try to map the entire extent of our galaxy. First time it's ever been done. This was published just a couple of weeks ago, and it's causing quite a stir in the astronomical community because nobody had any idea that our galaxy extended that far. I mean, if you do a Wikipedia in our galaxy, it'll say it's 100,000 light years across. This is basically telling us it's over 400,000 light years across. But again, I want to remind you, this is exaggerated for illustrative effect. The density of stars way far out is not anywhere near as extreme as what's shown in this image. The image was developed basically to show, hey, if you go far enough away, you can actually see some warping. And that's exactly what we expect, because when you get that far out, the stellar density is so low that all it takes is a really tiny dwarf galaxy coming nearby to distort it. If it was as extensive what you see there, it wouldn't be distorted. But again, this has been exaggerated for effect. Okay. Moving on, this paper just got published days ago. And this is actually going to tie into an Isaiah study, if I got sufficient time, okay? Because we're talking about how the universe will end. That little black dot that you see there in the center, that's the supermassive black hole. It's nowhere near that big. And our supermassive black hole weighs in at about 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. Every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its center. One of the unique features of our Milky Way galaxy, our supermassive black hole is really, really tiny given the size of our galaxy. It should be coming in 100 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. Instead, it only comes in at 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. If it was like other galaxies, there'd be so much deadly radiation coming out from it, no life would be possible. I mean, to go back to the Andromeda galaxy, its supermassive black hole is about 80 to 100 times as massive as 180 to 100 million times as massive as the star of the Sun. And that rules out the possibility of any kind of advanced life in the galaxy. Moreover, it's close enough to our galaxy, it would be a problem for us. Except for this interesting fact, right now the supermassive black hole in the Andromeda galaxy is really very quiet. It's not doing much. I mean, where it gets deadly is if it consumes a star or it consumes a big molecular cloud. When that happens, it pours out deadly radiation that kills everything for about a 6 month period. And you know, we don't do well for it without, for 6 months. So if that was at its normative activity level, we wouldn't be able to have human civilization on Earth. The Andromeda galaxy is close enough, it would be a problem. But one of the things astronomers have discovered is that right now there's not much activity in the supermassive black hole in the Andromeda galaxy. Moreover, when we get to our galaxy, it's extremely quiet. It does have flare activities on an hourly basis, but the flares are caused by our supermassive black hole not consuming stars or giant molecular clouds. It's consuming things the size of a comet. And because it's consuming things the size of a comet, you get these short-lived flares that are not dangerous for advanced life. But the paper that just got published is a study on this particular star. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Okay, that little red dot there, that's the supermassive black hole. And then you see that thing said S2. S2, that's a supergiant star. It's about 14 times the mass of our star, the Sun, and it's in a tight orbit around the supermassive black hole. How tight of an orbit? Every 16 years, it completes one orbit around the supermassive black hole. Now, because it weighs 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun, this is a case where you have general relativistic effects on the orbit. The orbit is not like what Newton would predict. You get a general relativistic correction. Now, in our solar system, those corrections are extremely tiny. In this case, they're not tiny at all. They're enormous. And so astronomers have been looking at this for 18 years, trying to use this as a test of the theory of general relativity. And they're particularly excited about using this as a probe for quantum gravity. Say, why is that important? This is the last-ditch attempt by atheist astrophysicists to try to escape the beginning of the universe and to escape the conclusion that there's a God behind the universe that created it. Because they said the space-time theorems presume that general relativity holds in all cases, and we've not been able to do tests at extremely strong gravitational fields. Maybe when the universe was extremely young and extremely tiny, you'd have these very strong gravitational fields, and maybe something exotic was happening. This is an attempt to put that to the test. Let's see if there's anything so exotic that it would allow an opportunity to escape the beginning. So this paper was literally published just days ago, making the point, not only do we have 18 years of measurement, just a few months ago, this star made its closest approach to the supermassive black hole. And when it makes its closest approach is when you get the most dramatic impact of general relativity. And the bottom line is, they said, general relativity passed with flying colors. If it passes with flying colors, the space-time theorems hold, and they even hold under the extreme strong gravity that we see adjacent to supermassive black holes, which would be akin to what we see happening in the quantum gravity era. In fact, the paper closed by saying we've been able to rule out a whole family of quantum gravity models thanks to these latest observations. And they also were able to determine a very accurate mass for our supermassive black hole. The old measurement was that it was 4.02 plus or minus 0.16. Notice it's now 3.964 with a much lower error bar. And you say, why is this important? Well, dropping it from 4.02 to 3.96 means that we get a little longer window of time in which it's safe to have human civilization. So a little bit of an adjustment there. But the biggest breakthrough here in terms of the cosmic creation models was they were able to get a much better measurement of the distance between Earth and that supermassive black hole. You say, why is this important? Because the distance between Earth and the center of our galaxy is the bottom rung of what they call the distance ladder scale, which is basically what's used to determine how fast the universe expands, how big the universe is, and how old the universe is. And a few weeks ago, a lot of you asked me to comment on this paper that basically said we got an enormous discrepancy between the expansion of the universe and the age of the universe based on Cepheid variable measurements of galaxies in close and what we get from the cosmic background radiation. This paper is one of two papers that is basically resolving that discrepancy. Because that paper was published a couple of months ago, was basically saying we got a 9% discrepancy. This is so discrepant, maybe we are completely wrong about what we think about how the universe was created and about its age. Okay, the old measurement was 8,122 parsecs. If you want that translated to light years, you see it there, 26,490. And so what you notice is the distance between us and the center of the galaxy shortened by about 2%. What that does is that it decreases the value of the Hubble constant based on nearby galaxies. And that was the problem. They were basically saying it looks like the universe is expanding a lot faster based on nearby measurements than far away measurements. This is basically saying, well, that takes care of 2 of the 9%. So reduces nearby Hubble constant measurements by 2.17%, which reduces the cosmic age discrepancy. But the real breakthrough was the team, by the way, the team is not very far away, Carnegie Observatories. They're in Pasadena, just north of Caltech. That's where the team was that said, we think we found a big discrepancy. Wendy Friedman and Barry Madore, by the way, went to grad school with both of them at the University of Toronto. They've been heading up the effort of measuring the age of the universe and the expansion rate of the universe based on nearby galaxies. But they published a rather stunning paper a few weeks ago where they said instead of using Cepheid variable stars to determine these measurements, we're going to use what's called the tip of the red giant branch. Say, what on earth is that? Okay, when you take freshman astronomy, they introduce you to what's called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And these were two 19th century astronomers who basically noticed that the population of stars tends to follow along these curves when you plot the temperature of the star versus its luminosity. And so you may have heard of something called the main sequence. That's that diagonal line there. And that's basically where stars reside when they're fusing hydrogen into helium. But when they run off hydrogen to fuse, they begin to fuse helium into heavier elements. And that's all the stuff you see to the upper right of the diagram. And when they finish with that, they basically have run out of fuel and they cool off and they become white dwarfs. You can think of white dwarfs as like an ember on an open fire. When a burning log runs out of fuel, it basically just cools down. And so it goes from, you know, red to orange and brown, and finally it becomes a black ember at the bottom of your fireplace. That's what's happening to these white dwarfs. And it's one reason why we know the universe can't be extremely old. We don't see any black dwarfs. All we see are white dwarfs. The universe is not yet old enough for a white dwarf to completely cool down. Say, how old does it have to be before you get black dwarfs? Oh, about 150 billion years. The universe is only 14 billion years old. But this is what was stunning. The very team that came out with a claim that the expansion rate of the universe was 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec, based on their Cepheid variable stars, and they're very confident saying this is the best measurement we've ever done with Cepheid variable stars. Just a couple of weeks ago, they said we decided to try a different method, expecting to get the same answer, and what did they get? 69.8 kilometers per second. And that's quite consistent with what you get from looking at the measurements based on the extreme early universe, namely the cosmic microwave background radiation. I showed you this chart a few weeks ago. And basically they're trying to make things consistent with the Planck map of the cosmic background radiation. For those of you not familiar with that, that's a map of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. But if you look at the 9-year W map, 69.3, that's really close to to 69.8. So basically, astronomers are saying, we think we just have been overlooking systematic errors. So, and I think that's what's remarkable about this earlier study here, looking at the star orbiting the galactic center. They purposely use four different telescopes, six different spectrographs, because it says we want to do a definitive work where we only have random errors and not systematic errors. Say, what on earth are systematic errors? Those are offsets that are created by your equipment or your technique. And basically, it shifts all the measurements in one direction or a different direction. And incidentally, it's only in physics and astronomy and geophysics that we really have a good clue what the systematic effects are. I mean, one of my critiques of the life sciences, they give you the random errors, and they basically say, we don't have a clue about the systematic errors. But the systematic errors can shift things dramatically. In the case now, these people said, we think we can get rid of all the systematic effects by using different telescopes, different spectrographs, different measuring techniques. They didn't get rid of them all, but they got the error bar down. Maximum effect from systematics was driven below 20 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is less than the random errors. So this is where we're now finally getting some really definitive work. But what's interesting is we get a better and better handle on the systematic errors. This discrepancy that got everybody concerned 2 months ago, it's basically going away. Now, I'm still on record as saying we're going to get a different measurement of the expansion rate of the universe when the universe was less than a billion years old than what we get today. That's because we already know gravity works in such a way that it slows down the expansion. And when the universe is small, the mass of bodies are close together, which means gravity is going to be stronger in its capacity to slow down the cosmic expansion. And dark energy is just the opposite. The bigger the universe gets, the stronger dark energy works to accelerate the expansion of the universe. So the mass of the universe and dark energy predicts you're going to get a slightly faster expansion rate today than you would if you measure the expansion rate as it was 13 or 14 a billion years ago. It's just that we expect about a 1% difference, maybe a 2% difference, but nowhere near a 9% difference. But the 9% difference now seems to be disappearing. Okay, I got a little bit of time left. Oh, we got a question?
We do.
I was hoping to get to Isaiah. All right, go ahead.
A real brief one.
All right.
What's at the ends of the bar structure of our galaxy? Are those less big black holes? Are they big stars? What root?
Are
what
you referring those? Back to this diagram here?
Yeah.
This one?
No.
No, not that one?
No, it's almost like two focuses of an ellipse at the ends of the ellipse. So what explains those as far as structure?
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. You're talking
about
this one?
The bar has two ends, and off the ends trail the arms.
Okay. This, again, is unique to the physical sciences, where we can actually measure what the random errors are. And that's basically where you're taking, say, 15 different measurements. And because of statistical effects and noise, you get a spread of measurements. So that would be the first number, which is they've called the statistical or the random error. The second number are measurements of maximum systematic effects. In other words, how much would your instrument or technique possibly offset all the measurements in one direction or the other. So that's what's referred to there as a systematic error. And that's really a small systematic error. Usually the systematic error dominates. But in this case, a team of 29 astronomers from all over the world said we're going to use multiple telescopes and multiple spectrographs on each of the telescopes in order to be able to reduce that error. Also, what they did to reduce the systematic effects, they went back here and said, let's find a bunch of stars that are as old and as big as this star elsewhere in the galaxy and compare spectral measurements on those stars with spectral measurements in this star. And by combination of those three methods, they were able to reduce the systematic error to just 0.026 million solar masses. And in the case of the distance, they were able to reduce it down to just literally 98 light years. So the error was made very small. So that's what's going on. But I always tell people who read the life sciences, keep in mind all you're getting are the statistical errors. You're not getting the systematic errors, mainly because you're dealing with a science that's so complicated, we can't even determine what the systematic effects are. But in astronomy, things are so simple, we can actually figure out what the systematics are if we take the time to use multiple instruments, multiple techniques, and look at many different stars in different locations of the galaxy. That's how you basically work to minimize the systematic errors. Okay, let me jump into what's relevant to our text. Yes, got a question from the live streamers?
Yes, we do. Someone wants to know, because we know so much more about the size of the Milky Way, does that mean it's now as big or bigger than Andromeda?
Okay, where we do apples to apples, because the question was, given that we now see how extensive the Milky Way galaxy is, does that mean that it's now bigger than the Andromeda galaxy? Well, notice it took really sophisticated sensitive equipment to see these very distant stars that are part of that very distant arm. We don't have the sensitivity and telescope power to pick that up on the Andromeda galaxy. But where we're able to use mass measurements of the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy, where we're using the same method and targeting the same part of the galaxy, we get roughly the same answer. It looks like the two galaxies have the same mass. However, what's really different, most of the mass in our Milky Way galaxy is not made up of stars. It's made up of dark matter. It's about 90% dark matter and 10% stars, planets, gas, and dust. Quite different with Andromeda. Andromeda, it's about a 50-50 ratio. In the case of Milky Way galaxy, it's a 90-10 ratio. And it's one reason why, when you look at our Milky Way galaxy, to pull this back here, it's got such stable, symmetrical spiral arms. All that exotic dark matter works to stabilize the structure. That's not the case with the Andromeda galaxy. So it's another reason why not only do you see a lot of warping in the Andromeda galaxy, you see that in between the spiral arms is loaded with feathers and spurs. And that's because it doesn't have the quantity of exotic dark matter our Milky Way galaxy does. It's got way more stars than our Milky Way galaxy. Moreover, it's being disturbed by these big dwarf galaxies. But one thing I can share with you, when it comes to spiral galaxies, Andromeda is the norm. Our Milky Way galaxy is the exception. I keep telling audiences that I've always been frustrated watching the Star Wars movies. I don't know how many of you are Star Wars fans, but every time I watch one of those movies, the opening frame is they show this bit of text coming up, and they talk about a galaxy far, far away. We astronomers have looked at galaxies far, far away. We're not finding any candidates. The only one that's a candidate is this one of the galaxies we've been able to observe. So I've always said, you know, they need to change the script. Forget about a galaxy far, far away. If you want advanced life, it's got to be here. But one thing we know about our Milky Way galaxy, there's only one spot in which advanced life can exist. I'll let you guess which spot that is. Okay. Well, I think some people will agree with you on that one. Okay, I don't have a lot of time left, but I will introduce the topic here. But bottom line is, everybody was worried that we had the wrong model for the universe. We had the wrong age for the universe. I think this age is going to stand up very well. It really looks like the combination of this latest measurement on tip of the red giant branch in the W map. And by the way, there are some differences between the W map of the cosmic microwave background radiation and what you get from Planck. Planck is more detailed.